The Fisherwoman's Daughter, 1988. I read the first version of this paper at Brown University and at Miami University in Ohio, and revised it heavily to read at Wesleyan College in Georgia. Then I wrote it all over again to read at Portland State University. I have a feeling I read it somewhere else, but can't reconstruct where. When I went to Tulane to be a Mellon Fellow, to be precise, a quarter of a Mellon, I rewrote it again, and that version, which I pretended was definitive, appeared in Tulane's series of Mellon papers, under the title A Woman Writing. Asked to give the talk in a benefit series in San Francisco, I decided to include more about my mother, whose writing life was lived in the Bay Area, and that led to another full revision. In preparing the manuscript of this book, I came to the immense folder containing the five, in places identical, in places widely differing, typescripts of the talk. And I thought, if I have to rewrite that thing once more, I will die. So I merely included the latest version, without rereading it. My ruthless editor would have none of that. "Pusillanimous woman," she said. "What about all the bits you left out?" "What about them?" I snarled. "I think if we just put them together, it will work," said she. "Show me," said I craftily. So she did. I hope it does. What pleases me most about the piece, after so much work on it, is that I can look on it, at last, as a collaboration. The responses from the various audiences I read it to, both questions in the lecture hall and letters afterward, guided and clarified my thinking and saved me from many follies and omissions. The present re-collation and editing has given me back the whole thing, not shapely and elegant, but a big crazy quilt. And that was my working title for it when I first began gathering material, Crazy Quilt. That name hints again at collaboration, which is what I saw myself doing as I pieced together the works and words of so many other writers, ancestors, strangers, friends. "So, of course," wrote Betty Flanders, pressing her heels rather deeper in the sand, "there was nothing for it but to leave." That is the first sentence of Virginia Woolf's Jacob's Room. It is a woman writing, sitting on the sand by the sea, writing. It's only Betty Flanders, and she's only writing a letter. But first sentences are doors to worlds. This world of Jacob's Room, so strangely empty at the end of the book, when the mother stands in it, holding out a pair of her son's old shoes and saying, "What am I to do with these?" This is a world in which the first thing one sees is a woman, a mother of children, writing. On the shore, by the sea, outdoors. Is that where women write? Not at a desk, in a writing room? Where does a woman write? What does she look like writing? What is my image, your image, of a woman writing? I asked my friends, "A woman writing, what do you see?" There would be a pause. Then the eyes would light up, seeing. Some sent me to paintings. Fragonard, Cossat. But mostly these turned out to be paintings of a woman reading, or with a letter. Not actually writing or reading the letter, but looking up from it with unfocused eyes. "Will he never, never return? Did I remember to turn off the pot roast?" Another friend responded crisply, "A woman writing is taking dictation." And another said, "She's sitting at the kitchen table, and the kids are yelling. And that last is the image I shall pursue. But first, let me tell you my own first answer to my question. Joe March. From the immediacy, the authority with which Frank Merrill's familiar illustrations of Little Women came to my mind as soon as I asked myself what a woman writing looks like, I know that Joe March must have had real influence upon me when I was a young scribbler. I am sure she has influenced many girls, for she is not, like most real authors, either dead or inaccessibly famous. Nor, like so many artists in books, is she set apart by sensitivity or suffering or general superlativity. Nor is she, like most authors in novels, male. She is close as a sister and common as grass. As a model, what does she tell scribbling girls? I think it worthwhile to follow the biography of Joe March, the writer, until we come to that person of whom, as a child and until quite recently, I knew almost nothing, Louisa May Alcott. We first meet Joe as a writer when Sister Amy vengefully burns her manuscript, the loving work of several years. It seemed a small loss to others, but to Joe it was a dreadful calamity. How could a book, several years' work, be a small loss to anyone? That horrified me. How could they ask Joe to forgive Amy? At least she nearly drowns her in a frozen lake before forgiving her. At any rate, some chapters later, Joe is very busy in the garret, seated on the old sofa, writing busily, with her papers spread out on a trunk before her. Joe's desk up here was an old tin kitchen. The OED says, New England, a roasting pan. So Joe's room of her own at this stage is a garret furnished with a sofa, a roasting pan, and a rat. To any 12-year-old, heaven. Joe scribbled away till the last page was filled, when she signed her name with a flourish. Lying back on the sofa, she read the manuscript carefully through, making dashes here and there, and putting in many exclamation points, which looked like little balloons. Then she tied it up with a smart red ribbon, and sat a minute looking at it, with a sober, wistful expression, which plainly showed how earnest her work had been. I am interested here by the counterplay of a deflating irony, the scribbling, the dashes, the balloons, the ribbon, and that wistful earnestness. Jo sends her story to a paper. It is printed, and she reads it aloud to her sisters, who cry at the right places. Beth asks, "Who wrote it?" The reader suddenly sat up, cast away the paper, displaying a flushed countenance, and with a funny mixture of solemnity and excitement replied, in a loud voice, "Your sister!" The March family makes a great fuss, for these foolish, affectionate people make a jubilee of every little household joy. And there again is deflation. A writer's first publication reduced to a little household joy. Does it not debase art? And yet, does it not also, by refusing the heroic tone, refuse to inflate art into something beyond the reach of any mere girl? So Jo goes on writing. Here she is some years later, and I quote at length, for this is the central image. Every few weeks, she would shut herself up in her room, put on her scribbling suit, and fall into a vortex, as she expressed it, writing away at her novel with all her heart and soul, for till that was finished, she could find no peace. Her scribbling suit consisted of a black woolen pinafore, on which she could wipe her pen at will, and a cap of the same material, adorned with a cheerful red bow. This cap was a beacon to the inquiring eyes of her family, who during these periods kept their distance, merely popping in their heads semi-occasionally to ask with interest, "Does genius burn, Joe?" They did not always venture even to ask this question, but took an observation of the cap and judged accordingly. If this expressive article of dress was drawn low upon the forehead, it was a sign that hard work was going on. In exciting moments, it was pushed rakishly askew. And when despair seized the author, it was plucked wholly off and cast upon the floor. At such times, the intruder silently withdrew. And not until the red bow was seen gaily erect upon the gifted brow did anyone dare address Joe. She did not think herself a genius by any means. But when the writing fit came on, she gave herself up to it with entire abandon and led a blissful life, unconscious of want, care, or bad weather, while she sat safe and happy in an imaginary world, full of friends almost as real and dear to her as any in the flesh. Sleep forsook her eyes, meals stood untasted. Day and night were all too short to enjoy the happiness which blessed her only at such times, and made these hours worth living, even if they bore no other fruit. The divine afflatus usually lasted a week or two, and then she emerged from her vortex, hungry, sleepy, cross, or despondent. This is a good description of the condition in which the work of art is done. This is the real thing, domesticated. The cap and bow, the facetious turns and the disclaimers, deflate without degrading, and allow Alcott to make a rather extraordinary statement, that Joe is doing something very important, and doing it entirely seriously, and that there is nothing unusual about a young woman's doing it. This passion of work and this happiness which blessed her in doing it are fitted without fuss into a girl's commonplace life at home. It may not seem much, but I don't know where else I or many other girls like me in my generation or my mother's or my daughter's were to find this model, this validation. Joe writes romantic thrillers, and they sell. Her father shakes his head and says, "Aim at the highest and never mind the money." But Amy remarks, "The money is the best part of it." Working in Boston as a governess seamstress, Joe sees that money conferred power. Money and power, therefore, she resolved to have, not to be used for herself alone, our author's author hastily adds, but for those whom she loved more than self. She took to writing sensation stories. Her first visit to the editorial office of the Weekly Volcano is handled lightly, but the three men treat her as a woman who has come to sell herself. True Levi-Straussians, to whom what a woman does is entirely subsumed in woman as commodity. Refusing shame, Joe writes on and makes money by her writing. Admitting shame, she does not tell them at home. Joe soon found that her innocent experience had given her but few glimpses of the tragic world which underlies society. So, regarding it in a business light, she set about supplying her deficiencies with characteristic energy. She searched newspapers for accidents, incidents, and crimes. She excited the suspicions of public librarians by asking for works on poisons. She studied faces in the street, and characters good, bad, and indifferent all about her. Much describing of other people's passions and feelings set her to studying and speculating about her own, a morbid amusement in which healthy young minds do not voluntarily indulge. But, which one might think appropriate, even needful, to the young novelist? However, wrongdoing always brings its own punishment, and when Jo most needed hers, she got it. Her punishment is administered by the angel in the house, in the form of Professor Bear. Knowing that she is soiling her pure soul, he attacks the papers she writes for. I do not like to think that good young girls should see such things. Jo weakly defends them, but when he leaves, she rereads her stories, 3 months' work, and burns them. Amy doesn't have to do it for her anymore. She can destroy herself. Then she sits and wonders, I almost wish I hadn't any conscience. It's so inconvenient. A cry from the heart of Bronson Alcott's daughter. She tries a pious tale and a children's story, which don't sell, and gives up. She corked up her inkstand. Beth dies, and trying to replace her, Jo tries to live for others, finally driving her mother to say, Why don't you write? That always used to make you happy. So she does, and she writes both well and successfully, until Professor Bear returns and marries her, evidently the only way to make her stop writing. She has his 2 boys to bring up, and then her 2 boys, and then all those little men in the next volume. At the end of Little Women, in the chapter called Harvest Time, she says, I haven't given up the hope that I may write a good book yet, but I can wait. The harvest seems indefinitely deferred. But in Rachel Blau Duplessis' phrase, Jo writes beyond the ending. In the 3rd volume, Jo's Boys, she has gone back in middle age to writing and is rich and famous. There is realism, toughness, and comedy in the descriptions of her managing the household, mothering the teenagers, writing her chapters, and trying to avoid the celebrity hunters. In fact, this, like the whole story of Jo the writer, is quite close to Louisa Alcott's own story, with one large difference. Jo marries and has children. Lou did not. And yet she undertook the responsibility for a family, some of whom were as improvident and self-centered as any baby. There is a heartbreaking note in her journal for April 1869, when she was suffering a bad spell of mercury poisoning. The calomel given her to cure fever when she was a nurse in the Civil War made her sick the rest of her life. Very poorly. Feel quite used up. Don't care much for myself, as rest is heavenly, even with pain. But the family seems so panic-stricken and helpless when I break down that I try to keep the mill going. 2 short tales for L, $50. 2 for Ford, $20. And did my editorial work, though 2 months are unpaid for. Roberts wants a new book, but am afraid to get into a vortex lest I fall ill. Alcott used the same word Jo used for her passions of writing. Here are a couple of journal passages comparable to the vortex passage in Little Women. August 1860. Moods, a novel. Genius burned so fiercely that for 4 weeks I wrote all day and planned nearly all night, being quite possessed by my work. I was perfectly happy, and seemed to have no wants. February 1861. Another turn at moods, which I remodeled. From the 2nd to the 25th, I sat writing. With a run at dusk, could not sleep, and for 3 days was so full of it I could not stop to get up. Mother made me a green silk cap with a red bow to match the old green and red party wrap, which I wore as a glory cloak. Thus arrayed, sat in a grove of manuscripts, living for immortality, as May said. Mother wandered in and out with cordial cups of tea, worried because I couldn't eat. Father thought it fine, and brought his reddest apples and hardest cider for my Pegasus to feed upon. It was very pleasant and queer while it lasted. And it is pleasant to see how the family whose debts she slaved to pay off, and which she strove so to protect and keep in comfort, tried to protect and help her in return. Like so many women of her century then, Lou Alcott had a family, though she did not marry. "Liberty is a better husband than love to many of us," she wrote. But in fact, she had very little liberty, in the sense of freedom from immediate personal responsibilities. She even had a baby, her sister May's. Dying from complications of childbirth, May asked the beloved older sister, then 48, to bring up little Lou, which she did until her death 8 years later. All this is complex, more complex, I think, than one tends to imagine. For the Victorian script calls for a clear choice, either books or babies for a woman, not both. And Jo seems to make that choice. I was annoyed at myself when I realized that I had forgotten Jo's survival as a writer, that my memory, except for one nagging scrap that led me to look up Jo's boys at last, had followed the script. That, of course, is the power of the script. You play the part without knowing it. Here is a classic, a scriptural description of a writing woman, the mother of children, one of whom is just now in the process of falling down the stairs. Mrs. Jellyby was a pretty, very diminutive, plump woman of from 40 to 50, with handsome eyes, though they had a curious habit of seeming to look a long way off. She had very good hair, but was too much occupied with her African duties to brush it. We could not help noticing that her dress didn't nearly meet up the back, and that the open space was railed across with a latticework of stay laces, like a summer house. The room, which was strewn with papers and nearly filled by a great writing table covered with similar litter, was, I must say, not only very untidy, but very dirty. We were obliged to take notice of that with our sense of sight, even while, with our sense of hearing, we followed the poor child who had tumbled downstairs, I think into the back kitchen, where somebody seemed to stifle him. But what principally struck us was a jaded and unhealthy-looking, though by no means plain, girl at the writing table, who sat biting the feather of her pen and staring at us. I suppose nobody ever was in such a state of ink. I will, with difficulty, restrain myself from reading you the rest of Bleak House. I love Dickens, and will defend his Mrs. Jellyby and her correspondence with Borrioboola-Gha as an eternal send-up of those who meddle with foreign morals while remaining oblivious to the misery under their nose. But I observe also that he uses a woman to make this point, probably because it was, and is, safe. Few readers would question the assumption that a woman should put family before public responsibility, or that if she does work outside the private sphere, she will be neglectful of her house, indifferent to the necks of her children, and incompetent to fasten her clothing. Mrs. Jellyby's daughter is saved from her enforced state of ink by marriage. But Mrs. Jellyby will get no help from her husband, a man so inert that their marriage is described as the union of mind and matter. Mrs. Jellyby is a joy to me. She is drawn with so much humor and good nature. And yet, she troubles me, because behind her lurks the double standard. Nowhere among Dickens' many responsible, intelligent women is there one who does real artistic or intellectual work to balance Mrs. Jellyby and reassure us that it isn't what she does, but how she does it, that is deplorable. And yet the passage just quoted is supposed to have been written by a woman, the character Esther Summerson. Esther herself is a problem. How does she write half Dickens' novel for him while managing Bleak House and getting smallpox and everything else? We never catch her at it. As a woman writing, Esther is invisible. She is not in the script. There may be a sympathetic portrait of a woman writer with children in a novel written by a man. I have read versions of this paper in Rhode Island, Ohio, Georgia, Louisiana, Oregon, and California, and asked each audience please to tell me if they knew of any such. I wait in hope. Indeed, the only sympathetic picture of a woman novelist in a man's novel that I know is the protagonist of Diana of the Crossways. Meredith shows her writing novels for her living, doing it brilliantly, and finding her freedom in her professionalism. But, self-alienated by a disastrous infatuation, she begins to force her talent and can't work. The script, apparently being that love is incidental for a man, everything for a woman. At the end, well off and happily married, she is expecting a baby, but not, it appears, a book. All the same, Diana still stands, nearly a century later, quite alone at her crossways. Invisibility as a writer is a condition that affects not only characters, but authors, and even the children of authors. Take Elizabeth Barrett Browning, whom we have consistently put to bed with a spaniel, ignoring the fact that when she wrote Aurora Leigh, she was the healthy mother of a healthy four-year-old, ignoring, in fact, the fact that she wrote Aurora Leigh, a book about being a woman writer, and how difficult one's own true love can make it for one. Here is a woman who had several children and was a successful novelist, writing a letter to her husband about 150 years ago, or maybe last night. If I am to write, I must have a room to myself, which shall be my room. All last winter, I felt the need of some place where I could go and be quiet. I could not write in the dining room, for there was all the setting of tables and clearing up of tables and dressing and washing of children and everything else going on, and I never felt comfortable there, though I tried hard. Then, if I came into the parlor where you were, I felt as if I were interrupting you, and you know you sometimes thought so too. What do you mean? Not at all. Silly notion, just like a woman. 14 years and several more children later, that woman wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. Most of it at the kitchen table. A room of one's own. Yes. One may ask why Mr. Harriet Beecher Stowe got a room to himself to write in While the woman who wrote the most morally effective American novel of the 19th century got the kitchen table. But then one may also ask why she accepted the kitchen table. Any self-respecting man would have sat there for 5 minutes and then stalked out shouting, "Nobody can work in this madhouse. Call me when dinner's ready." But Harriet, a self-respecting woman, went on getting dinner with the kids all underfoot and writing her novels. The first question, to be asked with awe, is surely, how? But then, why? Why are women such patsies? The quick feminist fix answer is that they are victims of and or accomplices with the patriarchy, which is true, but doesn't really get us anywhere new. Let us go to another woman novelist for help. I stole the Stowe quotation, and others, from Tilly Olson's Silences, a book to which this paper stands in the relation of a loving but undutiful daughter. "Hey, Ma, that's a neat quotation. Can I wear it?" This next one I found for myself. In the autobiography of Margaret Oliphant, a fascinating book, from the generation just after Stowe. Oliphant was a successful writer very young, married, had 3 kids, went on writing, was left a widow with heavy debts and the 3 kids, plus her brother's 3 kids to bring up, did so, went on writing. When her second book came out, she was still, like Jo March, a girl at home. "I had a great pleasure in writing, but the success and the 3 editions had no particular effect upon my mind. I had nobody to praise me except my mother and brother Frank and their applause. Well, it was delightful. It was everything in the world. It was life. But it did not count. They were part of me, and I of them. And we were all in it." I find that extraordinary. I cannot imagine any male author saying anything like that at all. There is a key here, something real that has been neglected, been hidden, been denied. The writing ran through everything, but then it was also subordinate to everything. To be pushed aside for any little necessity. I had no table even to myself, much less a room to work in, but sat at the corner of the family table with my writing book, with everything going on as if I had been making a shirt instead of writing a book. My mother sat always at needlework of some kind and talked to whoever might be present, and I took my share in the conversation, going on all the same with my story, the little groups of imaginary persons, these other talks evolving themselves quite undisturbed. How's that for an image? The group of imaginary people talking in the imaginary room, in the real room among the real people talking, and all of it going on perfectly quiet and unconfused. But it's shocking. She can't be a real writer. Real writers writhe on solitary sofas in cork-lined rooms, agonizing after le mot juste, don't they? My study, all the study I have ever attained to, is the little second drawing room where all the life of the house goes on. You recall that she was bringing up 6 children? And I don't think I have ever had 2 hours undisturbed, except at night when everybody is in bed, during my whole literary life. Miss Austen, I believe, wrote in the same way, and very much for the same reason. But at her period, the natural flow of life took another form. The family were half ashamed to have it known that she was not just a young lady like the others doing her embroidery. Mine were quite pleased to magnify me and to be proud of my work, but always with a hidden sense that it was an admirable joke. Perhaps artists cast off their families and go to the South Sea Islands because they want to be perceived as heroes, and their families think they are funny. A hidden sense that it was an admirable joke, and no idea that any special facilities or retirement was necessary. My mother would have felt her pride much checked, almost humiliated, if she had conceived that I stood in need of any artificial aids of that description. That would at once have made the work unnatural to her eyes, and also to mine. Oliphant was a proud Scotswoman, proud of her work and her strength. Yet she wrote nonfiction potboilers, rather than fight her male editors and publishers for better pay for her novels. So, as she says bitterly, Trollope's worst book was better paid than my best. Her best is said to be Miss Marchbanks, but I have never yet been able to get a copy of it. It was disappeared, along with all her other books. Thanks to publishers such as Virago, we can now get Oliphant's Hester, a stunning novel, and Kirstine, and a few others. But they are still taught, so far as I know, only in women's studies courses. They are not part of the canon of English literature, though Trollope's potboilers are. No book by a woman who had children has ever been included in that august list. I think Oliphant gives us a glimpse of why a novelist might not merely endure writing in the kitchen or the parlor amidst the children and the housework, but might endure it willingly. She seems to feel that she profited, that her writing profited, from the difficult, obscure, chancy connection between the artwork and the emotional, manual, managerial complex of skills and tasks called housework, and that to sever that connection would put the writing itself at risk, would make it, in her word, unnatural. The received wisdom, of course, is just the opposite, that any attempt to combine artwork with housework and family responsibility is impossible, unnatural. And the punishment for unnatural acts, among the critics and the cannoneers, is death. What is the ethical basis of this judgment and sentence upon the housewife artist? It is a very noble and austere one, with religion at its foundation. It is the idea that the artist must sacrifice himself to his art. I use the pronoun advisedly. His responsibility is to his work alone. It is a motivating idea of the Romantics. It guides the careers of poets from Rimbaud to Dylan Thomas to Richard Hugo. It has given us hundreds of hero figures, typical of whom is James Joyce himself and his Stephen Dedalus. Stephen sacrifices all lesser obligations and affections to a higher cause, embracing the moral irresponsibility of the soldier or the saint. This heroic stance, the Gauguin pose, has been taken as the norm, as natural to the artist, and artists, both men and women, who do not assume it, have tended to feel a little shabby and second-rate. Not, however, Virginia Woolf. She observed factually that the artist needs a small income and a room to work in, but did not speak of heroism. Indeed, she said, I doubt that a writer can be a hero. I doubt that a hero can be a writer. And when I see a writer assume the full heroic posture, I incline to agree. Here, for example, is Joseph Conrad. For 20 months I wrestled with the Lord for my creation, mind and will and conscience engaged to the full, hour after hour, day after day. A lonely struggle in a great isolation from the world. I suppose I slept and ate the food put before me and talked connectedly on suitable occasions, but I was never aware of the even flow of daily life, made easy and noiseless for me by a silent, watchful, tireless affection. A woman who boasted that her conscience had been engaged to the full in such a wrestling match would be called to account by both women and men. And women are now calling men to account. What put food before him? What made daily life so noiseless? What, in fact, was this tireless affection, which sounds to me like an old Ford in a junkyard, but is apparently intended as a delicate gesture towards a woman whose conscience was engaged to the full, hour after hour, day after day, for 20 months, in seeing to it that Joseph Conrad could wrestle with the Lord in a very relatively great isolation, well-housed, clothed, bathed, and fed? Conrad's struggle and Joe March Lou Alcott's vortex are descriptions of the same kind of all-out artistic work, and in both cases, the artist is looked after by the family. But I feel an important difference in their perceptions. Where Alcott receives a gift, Conrad asserts a right. Where she is taken into the vortex, the creative whirlwind, becoming part of it, he wrestles, struggles, seeking mastery. She is a participant. He is a hero. And her family remain individuals, with cups of tea and timid inquiries, while his is depersonalized to an affection. Looking for a woman writer who might have imitated this heroic infantilism, I thought of Gertrude Stein, under the impression that she had used Alice Toklas as a wife in this utilitarian sense. But that, as I should have guessed, is an anti-lesbian canard. Stein certainly took hero artist poses and indulged an enormous ego, but she played fair. And the difference between her domestic partnership and that of Joyce or Conrad is illuminating. And indeed, lesbianism has given many artists the network of support they need. For there is a heroic aspect to the practice of art. It is lonely, risky, merciless work. And every artist needs some kind of moral support or sense of solidarity and validation. The artist with the least access to social or aesthetic solidarity or approbation has been the artist housewife, a person who undertakes responsibility both to her art and to her dependent children, with no tireless affection or even tired affection to call on, has undertaken a full-time double job that can be simply, practically, destroyingly impossible. But that isn't how the problem is posed, as a recognition of immense practical difficulty. If it were, practical solutions would be proposed, beginning with childcare. Instead, the issue is stated, even now, as a moral one, a matter of ought and ought not. The poet Alicia Ostriker puts it neatly. That women should have babies rather than books is the considered opinion of Western civilization. That women should have books rather than babies is a variation on that theme. Freud's contribution to this doctrine was to invest it with such a weight of theory and mythology as to make it appear a primordial, unquestionable fact. It was, of course, Freud who, after telling his fiancée what it is a woman wants, said that what we shall never know is what a woman wants. Lacan is perfectly consistent in following him, if I, as a person without discourse, may venture to say so. A culture or a psychology predicated upon man as human and woman as other cannot accept a woman as artist. An artist is an autonomous, choice-making self. To be such a self, a woman must unwoman herself. Barren, she must imitate the man. Imperfectly, it goes without saying. Hence the approbation accorded Austen, the Brontes, Dickinson, and Plath, who, though she made the mistake of having two children, compensated for it by killing herself. The misogynist canon of literature can include these women because they can be perceived as incomplete women, as female men. Still, I have to grit my teeth to criticize the either books or babies doctrine, because it has given real, true comfort to women who could not or chose not to marry and have children, and saw themselves as having books instead. But though the comfort may be real, I think the doctrine false. And I hear that falseness when a Dorothy Richardson tells us that other women can have children, but nobody else can write her books. As if other women could have had her children. As if books came from the uterus. That's just the flip side of the theory that books come from the scrotum. This final reduction of the notion of sublimation is endorsed by our chief macho dodo writer, who has announced that the one thing a writer needs to have is balls. But he doesn't carry the theory of penile authorship to the extent of saying that if you get a kid, you can't get a book, and so fathers can't write. The analogy collapsed into identity, the you can't create if you procreate myth, is applied to women only. I've found I have to stop now and say clearly what I'm not saying. I'm not saying a writer ought to have children. I'm not saying a parent ought to be a writer. I'm not saying any woman ought to write books or have kids. Being a mother is one of the things a woman can do, like being a writer. It's a privilege. It's not an obligation or a destiny. I'm talking about mothers who write because it is almost a taboo topic, because women have been told that they ought not to try to be both a mother and a writer, because both the kids and the books will pay, because it can't be done, because it is unnatural. This refusal to allow both creation and procreation to women is cruelly wasteful. Not only has it impoverished our literature by banning the housewives, but it has caused unbearable personal pain and self-mutilation. Wolf, obeying the wise doctors who said she must not bear a child. Plath, who put glasses of milk by her kids' beds and then put her head in the oven. A sacrifice, not of somebody else, but of oneself, is demanded of women artists, while the Gauguin pose demands of men artists only that they sacrifice others. I am proposing that this ban on a woman artist's full sexuality is harmful not only to the woman, but to the art. There is less censure now and more support for a woman who wants both to bring up a family and work as an artist. But it's a small degree of improvement. The difficulty of trying to be responsible hour after hour, day after day, for maybe 20 years for the well-being of children and the excellence of books is immense. It involves an endless expense of energy and an impossible weighing of competing priorities. And we don't know much about the process, because writers who are mothers haven't talked much about their motherhood, for fear of boasting, for fear of being trapped in the mom trap, discounted. Nor have they talked much about their writing as in any way connected with their parenting, since the heroic myth demands that the two jobs be considered utterly opposed and mutually destructive. But we heard a hint of something else from Oliphant. And here, thanks Tilly, is the painter Käthe Kollwitz. I am gradually approaching the period in my life when work comes first. When both the boys were away for Easter, I hardly did anything but work. Worked, slept, ate, and went for short walks. But above all, I worked. And yet I wonder whether the blessing isn't missing from such work. No longer diverted by other emotions, I work the way a cow grazes. That is marvelous. I work the way a cow grazes. That is the best description of the professional at work I know. Perhaps in reality I accomplish a little more. The hands work and work, and the head imagines it's producing God knows what. And yet, formerly, when my working time was so wretchedly limited, I was more productive, because I was more sensual. I lived as a human being must live, passionately interested in everything. Potency is diminishing. This potency felt by a woman is a potency from which the hero artist has, and I choose my words carefully, cut himself off in an egoism that is ultimately sterile. But it is a potency that has been denied by women as well as men, and not just women eager to collude with misogyny. Back in the 70s, Nina Auerbach wrote that Jane Austen was able to write because she had created around her a child-free space. Germ-free, I knew. Odor-free, I knew. But child-free? And Austen? Who wrote in the parlor and was a central figure to a lot of nieces and nephews? But I tried to accept what Auerbach said, because although my experience didn't fit it, I was, like many women, used to feeling that my experience was faulty, not right, that it was wrong. So I was probably wrong to keep on writing in what was then a fully child-filled space. However, feminist thinking evolved rapidly to a far more complex and realistic position, and I, stumbling along behind, have been enabled by it to think a little for myself. The greatest enabler for me was always, is always, Virginia Woolf. And I quote now from the first draft of her paper, Professions for Women, where she gives her great image of a woman writing. I figure her really in an attitude of contemplation, like a fisherwoman sitting on the bank of a lake with her fishing rod held over its water. Yes, that is how I see her. She was not thinking, she was not reasoning, she was not constructing a plot. She was letting her imagination down into the depths of her consciousness, while she sat above, holding on by a thin, but quite necessary, thread of reason. Now I interrupt to ask you to add one small element to this scene. Let us imagine that a bit farther up the bank of the lake sits a child, the fisherwoman's daughter. She's about 5, and she's making people out of sticks and mud and telling stories with them. She's been told to be very quiet, please, while Mama fishes, and she really is very quiet, except when she forgets and sings or asks questions. and she watches in fascinated silence when the following dramatic events take place. There sits our woman writing, our fisherwoman. When? Suddenly, there is a violent jerk. She feels the line race through her fingers. The imagination has rushed away. It is taken to the depths. It is sunk heaven knows where into the dark pool of extraordinary experience. The reason has to cry stop. The novelist has to pull on the line and haul the imagination to the surface. The imagination comes to the top in a state of fury. Good heavens, she cries, how dare you interfere with me? How dare you pull me out with your wretched little fishing line? And I, that is, the reason, have to reply, my dear, you are going altogether too far. Men would be shocked. Calm yourself, I say, as she sits panting on the bank, panting with rage and disappointment. We have only got to wait 50 years or so. In 50 years, I shall be able to use all this very queer knowledge that you are ready to bring me, but not now. You see, I go on now, trying to calm her. I cannot make use of what you tell me, about women's bodies, for instance, their passions, and so on, because the conventions are still very strong. If I were to overcome the conventions, I should need the courage of a hero, and I am not a hero. I doubt that a writer can be a hero. I doubt that a hero can be a writer. Very well, says the imagination, dressing herself up again in her petticoat and skirts. We will wait. We will wait another 50 years. But it seems to me a pity.
It seems to me a pity. It seems to me a pity that more than 50 years have passed, and the conventions, though utterly different, still exist to protect men from being shocked. Still admit only male experience of women's bodies, passions, and existence. It seems to me a pity that so many women, including myself, have accepted this denial of their own experience and narrowed their perception to fit it, writing as if their sexuality were limited to copulation, as if they knew nothing about pregnancy, birth, nursing, mothering, puberty, menstruation, menopause, except what men are willing to hear. Nothing except what men are willing to hear about housework, childwork, life work, war, peace, living, and dying, as experienced in the female body and mind and imagination. Writing the body, as Wolfe asked, and Hélène Cixous asks, is only the beginning. We have to rewrite the world. White writing, Cixous calls it, writing in milk, in mother's milk. I like that image, because even among feminists, the woman writer has been more often considered in her sexuality as a lover than in her sexuality as pregnant, bearing, nursing, child-caring. Mother still tends to get disappeared. And in losing the artist mother, we lose where there's a lot to gain. Alicia Ostriker thinks so. The advantage of motherhood for a woman artist, she says. Have you ever heard anybody say that before? The advantage of motherhood for an artist? The advantage of motherhood for a woman artist is that it puts her in immediate and inescapable contact with the sources of life, death, beauty, growth, corruption. If the woman artist has been trained to believe that the activities of motherhood are trivial, tangential to the main issues of life, irrelevant to the great themes of literature, she should untrain herself. The training is misogynist. It protects and perpetuates systems of thought and feeling which prefer violence and death to love and birth. And it is a lie. We think back through our mothers, if we are women, declares Wolf. But through whom can those who are themselves mothers do their thinking? We all need data. We all need information, the sort provided by poets, novelists, artists, from within. As our knowledge begins to accumulate, we can imagine what it would signify to all women and men to live in a culture where childbirth and mothering occupied the kind of position that sex and romantic love have occupied in literature and art for the last 500 years, or that warfare has occupied since literature began. My book, Always Coming Home, was a rash attempt to imagine such a world, where the hero and the warrior are a stage adolescents go through on their way to becoming responsible human beings, where the parent-child relationship is not forever viewed through the child's eyes, but includes the reality of the mother's experience. The imagining was difficult and rewarding. Here is a passage from a novel where what Wolf, Sixu, and Ostriker ask for is happening, however casually and unpretentiously. In Margaret Drabble's The Millstone, Rosamond, a young scholar and freelance writer, has a baby about 8 months old, Octavia. They share a flat with a friend, Lydia, who's writing a novel. Rosamond is working away on a book review. I had just written and counted my first 100 words when I remembered Octavia. I could hear her making small, happy noises. I was rather dismayed when I realized she was in Lydia's room and that I must have left the door open, for Lydia's room was always full of nasty objects like aspirins, safety razors, and bottles of ink. I rushed along to rescue her, and the sight that met my eyes when I opened the door was enough to make anyone quake. She had her back to the door and was sitting in the middle of the floor, surrounded by a sea of torn, strewed, chewed paper. I stood there transfixed, watching the neat small back of her head and her thin, stalk-like neck and flowery curls. Suddenly, she gave a great screech of delight and ripped another sheet of paper. Octavia, I said in horror, and she started guiltily and looked round at me with a charming, deprecating smile. Her mouth, I could see, was wedged full of wads of Lydia's new novel. I picked her up and fished the bits out and laid them carefully on the bedside table with what was left of the typescript. Pages 70 to 123 seemed to have survived. The rest was in varying stages of dissolution. Some pages were entire, but badly crumpled. Some were in large pieces, some in small pieces, and some, as I have said, were chewed up. The damage was not, in fact, as great as it appeared at first sight to be. For babies, though persistent, are not thorough. But at first sight, it was frightful. In a way, it was clearly the most awful thing for which I had ever been responsible. But as I watched Octavia crawl around the sitting room looking for more work to do, I almost wanted to laugh. It seemed so absurd to have this small living extension of myself, so dangerous, so vulnerable, for whose injuries and crimes I alone had to suffer. It really was a terrible thing. And yet, in comparison with Octavia being so sweet and so alive, it did not seem so very terrible. Confronted with the wreckage Lydia is startled, but not deeply distressed. And that was it. Except for the fact that Lydia really did have to rewrite 2 whole chapters, as well as doing a lot of boring sellotaping. And when it came out, it got bad reviews anyway. This did succeed in making Lydia angry. I have seen Drabble's work dismissed with the usual list of patronizing adjectives reserved for women who write as women, not imitation men. Let us not let her be disappeared. Her work is deeper than its bright surface. What is she talking about in this funny passage? Why does the girl baby eat not her mother's manuscript, but another woman's manuscript? Couldn't she at least have eaten a manuscript by a man? No, that's not the point. The point, or part of it, is that babies eat manuscripts. They really do. The poem not written because the baby cried, the novel put aside because of a pregnancy, and so on. Babies eat books. But they spit out wads of them that can be taped back together, and they are only babies for a couple of years, while writers live for decades. And it is terrible, but not very terrible. The manuscript that got eaten was terrible. If you know Lydia, you know the reviewers were right. And that's part of the point, too, that the supreme value of art depends on other equally supreme values. But that subverts the hierarchy of values. Men would be shocked. In Drabble's Comedy of Morals, the absence of the hero artist is a strong ethical statement. Nobody lives in a great isolation. Nobody sacrifices human claims. Nobody even scolds the baby. Nobody is going to put their head or anybody else's head into an oven. Not the mother, not the writer, not the daughter. These 3 and 1 who, being women, do not separate creation and destruction into I create, you are destroyed, or vice versa. Who are responsible? Take responsibility for both the baby and the book. But I want now to turn from fiction to biography, and from general to personal. I want to talk a bit about my mother, the writer. Her maiden name was Theodora Krakow. Her first married name was Brown. Her second married name, Kroeber, was the one she used on her books. Her third married name was Quinn. This sort of many-namedness doesn't happen to men. It's inconvenient, and yet its very cumbersomeness reveals, perhaps, the being of a woman writer as not one simple thing, the author, but a multiple complex process of being, with various responsibilities, one of which is to her writing. Theodora put her personal responsibilities first, chronologically. She brought up and married off her 4 children before she started to write. She took up the pen, as they used to say, she had the most amazing left-handed scrawl, in her mid-50s. I asked her once, years later, did you want to write and put it off intentionally till you'd got rid of us? And she laughed and said, oh no, I just wasn't ready. Not an evasion or a dishonest answer, but not, I think, the whole answer. She was born in 1897 in a wild Colorado mining town, and her mother boasted of having been born with the vote in Wyoming, which ratified women's suffrage along with statehood, and rode a stallion men couldn't ride. But still, the angel in the house was very active in those days, the one whose message is that a woman's needs come after everybody else's. And my mother really came pretty close to incarnating that angel. whom Wolfe called the woman men wish women to be. Men fell in love with her. All men. Doctors, garage mechanics, professors, roach exterminators. Butchers saved sweetbreads for her. She was also, to her daughter, a demanding, approving, nurturing, good-natured, loving, lively mother. A first-rate mother. And then, getting on to 60, she became a first-rate writer. She started out, as women so often do, by writing some books for children. Not competing with men, you know, staying in the domestic sphere. One of these, A Green Christmas, is a lovely book that ought to be in every six-year-old stocking. Then she wrote a charming and romantic autobiographical novel, still on safe womanly ground. Next, she ventured into Native American territory with The Inland Whale. And then she was asked to write the story of an Indian called Ishi, the only survivor of a people massacred by the North American pioneers. A serious and risky subject, requiring a great deal of research, moral sensitivity, and organizational and narrative skill. So she wrote it. The first bestseller, I believe, that University of California Press ever published. Ishi is still in print in many languages. Still used, I think, in California schools. Still deservedly beloved. It is a book entirely worthy of its subject. A book of very great honesty and power. So, if she could write that in her 60s, what might she have written in her 30s? Maybe she really wasn't ready. But maybe she listened to the wrong angel. And we might have had many more books from her. Would my brothers and I have suffered, have been cheated of anything, if she had been writing them? I think my Aunt Betsy and the household help we had back then would have kept things going just fine. As for my father, I don't see how her writing could have hurt him or how her success could have threatened him. But I don't know. All I do know is that once she started writing, and it was while my father was alive, and they collaborated on a couple of things, she never stopped. She had found the work she loved. Once, not long after my father's death, when Ishi was bringing her the validation of praise and success she very much needed, and while I was still getting every story I sent out rejected with monotonous regularity, she burst into tears over my latest rejection slip and tried to console me, saying that she wanted rewards and success for me, not for herself. And that was lovely, and I treasured her saying it then as I do now. That she didn't really mean it, and I didn't really believe it, made no difference. Of course she didn't want to sacrifice her achievement, her work, to me. Why on earth should she? She shared what she could of it with me by sharing the pleasures and anguishes of writing, the intellectual excitement, the shop talk. And that's all. No angelic altruism. When I began to publish, we shared that. And she wrote on. In her 80s, she told me, without bitterness, I wish I had started sooner. Now there isn't time. She was at work on a third novel when she died. As for myself, I have flagrantly disobeyed the either books or babies rule, having had 3 kids and written about 20 books, and thank God it wasn't the other way around. By the luck of race, class, money, and health, I could manage the double tightrope trick, and especially by the support of my partner. He is not my wife, but he brought to marriage an assumption of mutual aid as its daily basis,
and on that basis, you can get a lot of work done. Our division of labor was fairly conventional. I was in charge of house, cooking, the kids, and novels, because I wanted to be. And he was in charge of being a professor, the car, the bills, and the garden, because he wanted to be. When the kids were babies, I wrote at night. When they started school, I wrote while they were at school. These days, I write as a cow grazes. If I needed help, he gave it without making it into a big favor. And this is the central fact. He did not ever begrudge me the time I spent writing or the blessing of my work. That is the killer. The killing grudge, the envy, the jealousy, the spite that so often a man is allowed to hold, trained to hold, against anything a woman does that's not done in his service, for him, to feed his body, his comfort, his kids. A woman who tries to work against that grudge finds the blessing turned into a curse. She must rebel and go it alone, or fall silent in despair. Any artist must expect to work amid the total rational indifference of everybody else to their work, for years, perhaps for life. But no artist can work well against daily, personal, vengeful resistance. And that's exactly what many women artists get from the people they love and live with. I was spared all that. I was free, born free, lived free. And for years, that personal freedom allowed me to ignore the degree to which my writing was controlled and constrained by judgments and assumptions which I thought were my own, but which were the internalized ideology of a male supremacist society. Even when subverting the conventions, I disguised my subversions from myself. It took me years to realize that I chose to work in such despised marginal genres as science fiction, fantasy, young adult, precisely because they were excluded from critical, academic, canonical supervision, leaving the artist free. It took 10 more years before I had the wits and guts to see and say that the exclusion of the genres from literature is unjustified, unjustifiable, and a matter not of quality, but of politics. So, too, in my choice of subjects. Until the mid-70s, I wrote my fiction about heroic adventures, high-tech futures, men in the halls of power, men. Men were the central characters. The women were peripheral, secondary. "Why don't you write about women?" my mother asked me. "I don't know how," I said. A stupid answer, but an honest one. I did not know how to write about women. Very few of us did. Because I thought that what men had written about women was the truth, was the true way to write about women. And I couldn't. My mother could not give me what I needed. When feminism began to reawaken, she hated it, called it those women's libbers. But it was she who had steered me years and years before to what I would and did need, to Virginia Woolf. We think back through our mothers, and we have many mothers, those of the body and those of the soul. What I needed was what feminism, feminist literary theory and criticism and practice, had to give me. And I can hold it in my hands. Not only 3 guineas, my treasure in the days of poverty, but now all the wealth of the Norton Anthology of Literature by Women, and the reprint houses, and the women's presses. Our mothers have been returned to us. This time, let's hang on to them. And it is feminism
that it's empowered me to criticize not only my society and myself, but for a moment now, feminism itself. The books or babies myth is not only a misogynist hang-up. It can be a feminist one. Some of the women I respect most, writing for publications that I depend on for my sense of women's solidarity and hope, continue to declare that it is virtually impossible for a heterosexual woman to be a feminist. As if heterosexuality were heterosexism, and that social marginality, such as that of lesbian, childless, Black or Native American women, appears to be necessary to form the feminist. Applying these judgments to myself, and believing that as a woman writing at this point, I have to be a feminist to be worth beans, I find myself once again excluded, disappeared. The rationale of the exclusionists, as I understand it, is that the material privilege and social approbation our society grants the heterosexual wife, and particularly the mother, prevent her solidarity with less privileged women and insulate her from the kind of anger and the kind of ideas that lead to feminist action. There is truth in this. Maybe it's true for a lot of women. I can oppose it only with my experience, which is that feminism has been a life-saving necessity to women trapped in the wife-mother role. What do the privilege and approbation accorded the housewife-mother by our society, in fact, consist of? Being the object of infinite advertising? Being charged by psychologists with total answerability for children's mental well-being, and by the government with total answerability for children's welfare, while being regularly equated with apple pie by sentimental warmongers? As a social role, motherhood, for any woman I know, simply means that she does everything everybody else does, plus bringing up the kids. To push mothers back into private life, a mythological space invented by the patriarchy, on the theory that their acceptance of the role of mother invalidates them for public, political, artistic responsibility, is to play old Nobodaddy's game, by his rules, on his side. In Writing Beyond the Ending, Du Plessis shows how women novelists write about the woman artist. They make her an ethical force, an activist trying to change the life in which she is also immersed. To have and bring up kids is to be about as immersed in life as one can be, but it does not always follow that one drowns. A lot of us can swim. Again, whenever I give a version of this paper, somebody will pick up on this point and tell me that I'm supporting the superwoman syndrome, saying that a woman should have kids, write books, be politically active, and make perfect sushi. I am not saying that. We're all asked to be superwoman. I'm not asking it. Our society does that. All I can tell you is that I believe it's a lot easier to write books while bringing up kids than to bring up kids while working 9 to 5 plus housekeeping. But that is what our society, while sentimentalizing over mom and the family, demands of most women, unless it refuses them any work at all and dumps them onto welfare and says, "Bring up your kids on food stamps, Mom. We might want them for the army." Talk about superwomen. Those are the superwomen. Those are the mothers up against the wall. Those are the marginal women, without either privacy or publicity. And it's because of them more than anyone else that the woman artist has a responsibility to try to change the life in which she is also immersed. And now I come back round to the bank of that lake, where the fisherwoman sits, our woman writer, who had to bring her imagination up short because it was getting too deeply immersed. The imagination dries herself off, still swearing under her breath, and buttons up her blouse, and comes to sit beside the little girl, the fisherwoman's daughter. "Do you like books?" she says. And the child says, "Oh, yes. When I was a baby, I used to eat them. But now I can read. I can read all of Beatrix Potter by myself, and when I grow up, I'm going to write books, like Mama."
"Are you going to wait till your children grow up, like Joe March and Theodora?"
"Oh, I don't think so," says the child. "I'll just go ahead and do it."
"Then will you do as Harriet and Margaret, and so many Harriets and Margarets have done and are still doing, and hassle through the prime of your life, trying to do two full-time jobs that are incompatible with each other in practice, however enriching their interplay may be, both to the life and the art?"
"I don't know," says the little girl. "Do I have to?"
"Yes," says the imagination. "If you aren't rich, and you want kids."
"I might want one or two,"
says Reason's child.
"But why do women have two jobs where men only have one? It isn't reasonable, is it?"
"Don't ask me," snaps the imagination. "I could think up a dozen better arrangements before breakfast. But who listens to me?"
The child sighs and watches her mother fishing. The fisherwoman, having forgotten that her line is no longer baited with the imagination, isn't catching anything. But she's enjoying the peaceful hour. And when the child speaks again, she speaks softly.
"Tell me, Auntie, what is the one thing a writer has to have?"
"I'll tell you," says the imagination. "The one thing a writer has to have is not balls, nor is it a child-free space, nor is it even, speaking strictly on the evidence, a room of her own, though that is an amazing help, as is the goodwill and cooperation of the opposite sex, or at least the local in-house representative of it. But she doesn't have to have that. The one thing a writer has to have is a pencil and some paper. That's enough, so long as she knows that she and she alone is in charge of that pencil, and responsible, she and she alone, for what it writes on the paper. In other words, that she's free. Not wholly free, never wholly free, maybe very partially. Maybe only in this one act, this sitting for a snatched moment, being a woman writing, fishing the mind's lake. But in this, responsible. In this, autonomous. In this, free.
"Auntie," says the little girl, "can I go fishing with you now?"